Mamet had survived the fall. It wouldn't survive that. This was more than mere pettiness. Davy had signaled me 20 minutes ago, letting me know she'd already tried the wax Mamet. Since there had been no result, it meant Ambrose had undoubtedly used my blood to make a clay Mamet of me. A simple fire wasn't going to destroy it. One by one, I grabbed the other drawers and threw them into the street as well, pausing to pull down the thick velvet curtains around Ambrose's bed to shield my hands from the heat of the fire. This also might seem petty, but it wasn't. I was terrified of burning my hands. Every talent I had revolved around them. Petty was when I kicked the chamber pot on my way back to the bureau. It was the expensive kind, fine glazed pottery. It tipped over and rolled crazily across the floor until it struck the hearth and shattered. Suffice to say that what spilled across Ambrose's rugs was not delicious candy. Flame flickered openly in the spaces where the drawers had been, lighting the room while the broken window let in some clear air. Eventually, someone else was brave enough to make their way into the room. He used one of the blankets off Ambrose's bed to protect his hands and helped me throw the last several burning drawers out the window. It was hot, sooty work, and even with the help, I was coughing by the time the last of the drawers went tumbling onto the street. It was over in less than 3 minutes. A few quick-thinking bar patrons brought in pitchers of water and doused the still-burning frame of the empty bureau. I tossed the smoldering velvet drapes out the window, shouting, "Look out down there!" so Simon would know to retrieve my siege stone from the pile of tangled cloth. Lamps were lit, and the smoke thinned as cool night air blew in through the broken window. People filtered into the room to help, or gawk, or gossip. A cluster of amazed onlookers gathered around Ambrose's staved-in door, and I idly wondered what sort of rumors might spring out of tonight's performance. Once the room was properly lit, I marveled at the damage the fire had done. The chest of drawers was little more than a collection of charred sticks, and the plaster wall behind it was cracked and blistered from the heat. The white ceiling was painted with a wide fan of black soot. I caught my reflection in the dressing room mirror and was pleased to see my eyebrows were more or less intact. I was mightily disheveled, my hair in disarray and my face smudged with sweat and dark ash. The whites of my eyes looked very bright against the black of my face. Willem joined me and helped bandage up my left hand. It wasn't really burned, but I knew it would look odd if I walked away entirely unscathed. Aside from a little lost hair, my worst injury was actually the holes charred in my long sleeves. Another shirt ruined. If this kept up, I'd be naked by the end of the term. I sat on the edge of the bed and watched as people brought more water to splash on the bureau. I pointed out a charred ceiling beam, and they doused it, too, sending up a sharp hiss and a cloud of steam and smoke. People continued to wander in and out, looking at the wreckage and muttering to each other while shaking their heads. Just as Will was finishing my bandage, the sound of galloping hooves on cobblestones came through the broken window, temporarily overwhelming the noise of fiercely stomping hobnailed boots. Less than a minute later, I heard Ambrose in the hallway.
"What in the name of God is going on here? Get out! Out!"
Cursing and shoving people aside, Ambrose made his entrance. When he saw me sitting on his bed, he pulled up short.
"What are you doing in my rooms?" he demanded.
"What?" I asked, then looked around.
"These are your rooms?"
Keeping the proper amount of dismay in my tone wasn't easy, as my voice was rough with smoke.
"I just burned myself saving your things?"
Ambrose's eyes narrowed, then went to the charred wreckage of his bureau. His eyes flicked back to me, then went wide with sudden realization. I fought the urge to grin.
"Get out of here, you filthy, thieving roux!" he spat venomously. "I swear, if anything's missing, I'll bring the constable down on you. I'll have you on the iron law and see you hanged."
I drew a breath to respond, then started to cough uncontrollably and had to settle for glaring at him.
"Good job, Ambrose," Willem said sarcastically. "You caught him. He stole your fire."
One of the onlookers chimed in.
"Yeah, make him put it back." Get out! Ambrose shouted, red-faced and furious. And take that filthy shim with you, or I'll give you both a thrashing you deserve. I watched the bystanders stare at Ambrose, appalled by his behavior. I gave him a long, proud look, playing the scene for all it was worth. You're welcome, I said with injured dignity, and shouldered past him, jostling him roughly out of the way. As I was leaving, a fat, florid man in a waistcoat staggered through the ruined door to Ambrose's rooms. I recognized him as the owner of the Golden Pony.
What the devil's been going on in here? He demanded.
Candles are dangerous things, I said. I looked over my shoulder and met Ambrose's eye. Honestly, boy, I said to him, I don't know what you were thinking. You'd think a member of the Arcanum would have more sense. Will, Mola, Davy, and I were sitting around what was left of the bonfire when we heard the crackle of footsteps coming through the trees. Fella was still dressed elegantly, but her hair was unpinned. Sim was making his way carefully alongside her, absent-mindedly holding branches out of her way as they moved through the undergrowth.
"And just where have you two been?" Davy asked.
"I had to walk back from Imre," Fella explained. "Sim came to meet me halfway. Don't worry, Mother, he was a perfect gentleman."
"I hope it wasn't too bad for you," I said.
"Dinner was about what you would expect," Fella admitted. "But the second part made it all worthwhile."
"Second part?" Mola asked.
"On our way back, Sim took me to see the wreckage at the pony. I stopped to have a word with Ambrose. I've never had so much fun." Fella's smile was wicked. "I was perfectly huffy."
"She was," Simmons said. "It was brilliant."
Fella faced Sim and set her hands on her hips.
"Run off on me, will you?"
Sim screwed his face up into an exaggerated scowl and gestured wildly.
"Listen to me, you daft bint," he said in a fair imitation of Ambrose's vintage accent. "My rooms were on fire."
Fella turned away, throwing up her hands.
"Don't lie to me. You ran off to be with some whore. I've never been so humiliated in my life. I never want to see you again."
We applauded. Fella and Sim linked arms and took a bow. "In the interest of pure accuracy," Fella said in an offhand way, "Ambrose didn't use the word daft bint." She didn't let go of Sim's arm. Simon looked a little embarrassed.
"Yes, well, there are some things you don't call a lady, even in fun."
He reluctantly let go of Fella and sat on the trunk of the fallen tree. Fella sat next to him. Fella leaned close to him and whispered something. Sim laughed, shaking his head.
"Please?"
Fella asked, laying her hand on his arm. "Quoth doesn't have his lute. Someone has to entertain us."
"Okay, okay," Simmons said, obviously a little flustered.
He closed his eyes for a moment, then spoke in a sonorous voice. Fast came our Fella, fiery eyes flashing. Crossing the cobbles, strength in her stride. Came she to Ambrose, all ashes around him. Grim was his gazing, fearsome his frown. Still Fella feared not. Brave was her Simon came to an abrupt stop before saying the word bosom and blushed red as a beet. Davy gave an earthy chuckle from where she sat on the other side of the fire. Ever the good friend, Willem stepped in with a distracting question.
"What is the pause you keep doing?" he asked. "It's like you can't catch your breath."
"I ask that too," Fella said, smiling.
"It's something they use in Eldvintic verse," Sim explained. "It's a break in the line called a sesura."
"You are dangerously well informed about poetry, Sim," I said. "I'm close to losing respect for you."
"Hush," Fella said. "I think it's lovely. You're just jealous he can do it off the cuff."
"Poetry is a song without music," I said loftily. "A song without music is like a body without a soul." Willem raised his hand before Simon could respond.
"Before we become mired in philosophical talk, I have a confession to make," Willem said somberly. I dropped a poem in the hallway outside Ambrose's rooms. It was an acrostic that spoke of his powerful affection for Master Hem.
We all laughed, but Simmons seemed to find it particularly funny. It took him a long while to catch his breath.
"It couldn't be more perfect if we planned it," he said. "I bought a few pieces of women's clothing and scattered them in with what was out on the street. Red satin, lacy bits, a whalebone corset."
There was more laughter. Then they turned their eyes to me.
"And what did you do?"
Davy prompted.
"Only what I set out to," I said somberly. "Only what was necessary to destroy the Mammoth so I could sleep safe at night."
"You kicked over his chamber pot," Willem said.
"True," I admitted. "And I found this." I held up a piece of paper. "If that's one of his poems," Davy said, "I'd suggest you burn it quickly and wash your hands."
I unfolded the slip of paper and read it aloud. "Ledger mark 4535, ring, white gold, blue smokestone, remount setting and polish."
I folded it carefully and put it in a pocket.
"To me," I said, "this is better than a poem."
Sim sat upright. "Is that a pawn slip for your lady's ring?"
"It's a claim slip for a jeweler, if I don't miss my guess. But yes, it's for her ring," I said. "And she's not my lady, by the by."
"I'm lost," Davy said.
"That's how all this started," Willem said. "Quoth was trying to reclaim a bit of property for a girl he fancies."
"Someone should fill me in," Davy said. "I seem to have come in halfway through the story."
I leaned back against a piece of fieldstone, content to let my friends tell the story. The slip of paper hadn't been in Ambrose's chest of drawers. It hadn't been on the hearth or his bedside table. It hadn't been on his jewelry tray or his writing desk. It had, in fact, been in Ambrose's purse. I'd lifted it off him in a fit of pique half a minute after he called me a filthy thieving roue. It had almost been a reflex action as I'd brushed roughly past him on my way out of his rooms at the pony. By strange coincidence, the purse also contained money. Almost 6 talents. Not a great deal of coin as far as Ambrose was concerned. Enough for an extravagant night out with a lady, but for me, it was a great deal of money. So much, I almost felt guilty for taking it. Almost.
Chapter 34. Baubles. There was no note for me from Denna when I returned to Anchors that night. Nor was there one waiting in the morning. I wondered if the boy had ever found her with my message, or if he had simply given up, or dropped it in the river, or eaten it. The next morning, I decided my mood was too good to spoil it with the inevitable madness of Elodin's class. So I shouldered my loot and headed over the river to look for Denna. It had taken longer than I'd planned, but I was eager to see the look on her face when I finally returned her ring. I walked into the jeweler's and smiled at the small man standing behind a low display case.
"Are you finished with the ring?"
His forehead creased.
I beg your pardon, sir?"
I sighed and dug around in my pocket, eventually producing the slip of paper. He peered at it. Then his face lit with understanding.
"Ah, yes, of course. Just a moment."
He made his way through a door into the back of the shop. I relaxed a bit. This was the third shop I'd visited. The other conversations hadn't worked out nearly this well. The tiny man bustled out of the back room.
"Here we are, sir."
He held up the ring.
"Right as rain again. Lovely stone, too, if you don't mind my saying."
I held it to the light. It was Denna's ring.
"You do good work," I said.
He smiled at this.
"Thank you, sir. All told, the work came to 45 pennies.
I gave a small, silent sigh. It had been too much to hope that Ambrose had paid for the work in advance. I juggled numbers in my head and counted 1 talent and 6 jots onto the glass top of the display case. As I did, I noticed it had the slightly oily texture of twice-tough glass. I ran my hand over it, wondering idly if it was one of the pieces I had made at the fishery. As the jeweler gathered up the coins, I noticed something else, something inside the case.
"A bauble caught your eye?"
he asked smoothly. I pointed at a necklace in the center of the case.
"You have excellent taste,"
he said, pulling out a key and unlocking a panel in the back of the case.
"This is quite an exceptional piece. Not only is the setting elegant, but the stone itself is remarkably fine. You don't often see an emerald of this quality cut in a long drop."
"Is it your work?" I asked. The jeweler gave a dramatic sigh.
"Alas, I cannot claim that distinction. A young woman brought it in several span ago. She had more need of money than adornment, it seems, and we came to an arrangement."
"How much would you like for it?" I asked as casually as possible. He told me. It was a staggering amount of money. More money than I had ever seen in one place. Enough money that a woman might live comfortably in Imre for several years. Enough money for a fine new harp. Enough for a lute of solid silver, or, if she desired, a case for such a lute. The jeweler sighed again, shaking his head at the sad state of the world.
"It is a shame," he said. "Who can tell what drives young women to such things?"
Then he looked up and smiled, holding the teardrop emerald to the light with an expectant expression.
"Still, her loss is your gain."
Since Denna had mentioned the barrel and boar in her note, I decided to start looking for her there. My loot case hung heavier on my shoulder now that I knew what she'd given up to pay for it. Still, one good turn deserves another, and I hoped the return of her ring would help balance things between us. But the Barrel and Boar wasn't an inn, merely a restaurant. Without any real hope, I asked the host if someone might have left a message for me. Nobody had. I asked if he remembered a woman who had been there the night before, dark-haired, lovely. He nodded at that.
"She waited for a long while," he said. "I remember thinking, who would keep a woman like that waiting?"
You would be amazed at how many inns and boarding houses there are, even in a smallish city like Imre.
Chapter 35. Secrets. 2 days later, I was heading off to the fishery, hoping some honest work would clear my head and make me better able to tolerate 2 hours of Elodin's jackassery. I was 3 steps from the door when I saw a young girl in a blue cloak hurrying across the courtyard toward me. Underneath the hood, her face was a startling mix of excitement and anxiety. We made eye contact, and she stopped moving toward me. Then, still eyeing me, she made a motion so furtive and stiff I couldn't understand what she meant until she repeated it. She wanted me to follow her. Puzzled, I nodded. She turned and walked out of the courtyard, moving with the awkward stiffness of someone trying desperately to be nonchalant. I followed her. Under other circumstances, I would have thought she was a shill luring me into a dark alley where thugs would kick out my teeth and take my purse. But there weren't any decently dangerous alleys this close to the university, and it was a sunny afternoon besides. Eventually, she stepped into a deserted piece of road behind a glassblower and a clocksmith shop. She looked around nervously, then turned, her face beaming under the shelter of her hood.
"I finally found you," she said breathlessly.
She was younger than I thought, no more than 14. Curls of mousy brown hair framed her pale face and fought to escape the hood. Still, I couldn't place her.
"I've had a drummer of a time tracking you down," she said. "I spend so much time here, my ma thinks I have a beau at the university."
She said the last almost shyly, her mouth making a tiny curve. I opened my mouth to admit I didn't have the slightest idea who she was, but before I could get a word out, she spoke again.
"Don't worry," she said. "I ain't let anyone know I was coming to see you."
Her bright eyes went dark with anxiety, like a pool when the sun goes behind a cloud.
"I know it's safer that way."
It was only when her face went dark with worry that I recognized her. She was the young girl I'd met in Traben when I'd gone to investigate rumors of the Chandrian.
Nina,
I said. What are you doing here?
Looking for you.
She thrust out her chin proudly.
I knew you must be here, 'cause you knew all sorts of magic.
She looked around.
But it's bigger than I thought it would be. I know you didn't give anyone in Traben your name, 'cause then they'd have power over you. But I have to say, it makes it terribly hard to find.
Had I not told anyone my name in Traben? Some of my memories of that time were vague, as I'd had a bit of a concussion. It was probably for the best I'd kept myself anonymous, given that I'd been responsible for burning down a sizable portion of the town. I'm sorry to put you to so much work, I said, still not sure what this was all about. Nina took a step closer.
I had dreams after you left, she said,
her voice low and confidential.
Bad dreams. I thought they were coming for me because of what I told you.
She gave me a meaningful look.
But then, I started sleeping with the amulet you gave me. I made my prayers every night, and the dreams went away.
One of her hands absent-mindedly fingered a piece of bright metal that hung around her neck on a leather cord. I realized with sudden guilt that I'd inadvertently lied to Master Kilvin. I hadn't sold anyone a charm, or even made anything that would look like one, but I had given Nina an engraved piece of metal and told her it was an amulet to set her mind at ease. Before that, she'd been on the edge of nervous hysteria, worried that demons were going to kill her.
"So it's been working, then?" I asked, trying not to sound guilty.
She nodded.
"As soon as I had it under my pillow and said my prayers, I slept like a babe at the tit. Then I started having my special dream," she said, and smiled up at me. "I dreamed about the big pot Jimmy showed me before those folks were killed up at the Mothin farm."
I felt hope rise in my chest. Nina was the only person alive who had seen the ancient piece of pottery. It had been covered with pictures of the Chandrian, and they are jealous of their secrets. "You remembered something about the pot with the 7 people painted on it?" I asked excitedly. She hesitated for a moment, frowning.
"There was 8 of them," she said. "Not 7.
8? I asked. "Are you sure?" She nodded earnestly.
"I thought I told you before."
The rising hope in my chest suddenly fell into the pit of my stomach where it lay heavy and sour. There were 7 Chandrian. It was one of the few things I knew for certain about them. If there were 8 people on the painted vase Nina had seen... Nina continued to chatter away, unaware of my disappointment.
"I dreamed about the pot for 3 nights in a row," she said, "and it weren't a bad dream at all. I woke up all rested and happy every night. I knew then what God was telling me to do."
She began to root around in her pockets and brought out a length of polished horn more than a hand span long and big around as my thumb.
"I remembered how you were so curious about the pot, but I couldn't tell you anything 'cause I'd only seen it for a moment."
She handed me the piece of horn proudly. I looked down at the cylindrical piece of horn in my hands, not sure what I was supposed to do with it. I looked up at her, confused. Nina gave an impatient sigh and took the horn back. She twisted it, removing the end like a cap.
"My brother made this for me," she said as she carefully drew a rolled
piece of parchment from inside the horn.
"Don't worry. He doesn't know what it was for."
She handed me the parchment.
"It's not very good," she said nervously.
"My mom lets me help paint the pots, but this is different. It's harder doing people than flowers and designs, and it's hard getting something right that you can only see in your head." I was amazed my hands weren't shaking. "This is what was painted on the vase?" I asked.
"It's one side of it," she said. "Something round like this, you can only see a third of it when you're looking at it from one side."
"So you dreamed of a different side each night?" I asked. She shook her head.
"Just this side, 3 nights in a row."
I slowly unrolled the piece of paper and instantly recognized the man she had painted. His eyes were pure black. In the background,
There was a bare tree, and he was standing on a circle of blue with a few wavy lines on it. "That's supposed to be water," she said, pointing. "It's hard to paint water, though, and he's supposed to be standing on it. There were drifts of snow around him, too, and his hair was white, but I couldn't get the white paint to work. Mixing paints for paper is harder than glazes for pots." I nodded, not trusting myself to speak. It was Cinder, the one who had killed my parents. I could see his face in my mind without even trying, without even closing my eyes. I unrolled the paper further. There was a second man, or rather, the shape of a man, in a great hooded robe. Inside the cowl of the robe was nothing but blackness. Over his head were three moons, a full moon, a half moon, and one that was just a crescent. Next to him were two candles. One was yellow with a bright orange flame. The other candle sat underneath his outstretched hand. It was gray with a black flame, and the space around it was smudged and darkened.
"That's supposed to be shadow, I think," Nina said, pointing to the area under his hand. "It was more obvious on the pot. I had to use charcoal for that. I couldn't get it right with paint."
I nodded again. This was Haliax, the leader of the Chandrian. When I'd seen him, he had been surrounded by an unnatural shadow. The fires around him had been strangely dimmed, and the cowl of his cloak had been black as the bottom of a well. I finished unrolling the paper, revealing a third figure, larger than the other two. He wore armor and an open-faced helmet. On his chest was a bright insignia that looked like an autumn leaf, red on the outside, brightening to orange near the middle, with a straight black stem. The skin of his face was tan, but the hand he held poised upright was a bright red. His other hand was hidden by a large, round object that Nina had somehow managed to color a metallic bronze. I guessed it was his shield.
"He's the worst," Nina said, her voice subdued.
I looked down at her. Her face looked somber, and I guessed she'd taken my silence the wrong way.
"You shouldn't say that," I said. "You've done a wonderful job."
Nina gave a faint smile.
"That's not what I meant," she said. "He was hard to do. I got the copper pretty okay here."
She touched his shield.
"But this red?"
Her finger brushed his upraised hand. "It's supposed to be blood. He's got blood all over his hand." She tapped his chest.
"And this was brighter, like something burning."
I recognized him then. It wasn't a leaf on his chest. It was a tower wrapped in flame. His bloody, outstretched hand wasn't demonstrating something. It was making a gesture of rebuke toward Haliax and the rest. He was holding up his hand to stop them. This man was one of the Aemir, one of the Ciridae. The young girl shivered and pulled her cloak around herself.
"I don't like looking at him even now," she said. "They were all awful to look at, but he was the worst. I can't get faces right, but his was terrible grim. He looked so angry. He looked like he was ready to burn down the whole world."
"If this is one side," I asked, "do you remember the rest of it?"
"Not like this. I remember there was a woman with no clothes on, and a broken sword, and a fire."
She looked thoughtful, then shook her head again.
"Like I told you, I only saw it for a quick second when Jimmy showed me. I think an angel helped me remember this piece in a dream so I could paint it down and bring it to you."
"Nina," I said, "this is really amazing. You really have no idea how incredible this is." Her face lit up again with a smile.
"I'm glad of that. I've had a world of trouble making it."
"Where did you get the parchment?" I asked, noticing it for the first time. It was actual vellum, high-quality stuff. Far better than anything I could afford.
"I practiced on some boards at first," she said, "but I knew that wasn't going to work. Plus, I knew I'd have to hide it, so I snuck into the church and cut some pages out of their book."
She said the last without the faintest hint of self-consciousness. "You cut this out of the Book of the Path?" I asked, somewhat aghast. "I'm not particularly religious, but I do have a vestigial sense of propriety. And after so many hours in the archives, the thought of cutting pages out of a book was horrifying to me. Nina nodded easily. It seemed the best thing, since an angel gave me the dream. And they can't lock the church up properly at night, since you tore off the front of the building and killed that demon. She reached over and brushed at the paper with a finger. It ain't that hard. All you need to do is take a knife and scrape at it a bit and all the words come off. She pointed. I was careful never to scrape off Talu's name, though. Or Andan's. Or any of the other angels, she added piously. I looked at it more closely and saw it was true. She'd painted the Amir so the words Andan and Ordal rested directly on top of his shoulders, one on each side, almost as if she were hoping the names would weigh him down or trap him. Plus, you said I shouldn't tell anyone what I saw, Nina said. And painting is like telling with pictures instead of words, so I figured it would be safer to use pages from Talu's book, because no demon would ever look at a page of that book, especially one with Talu's name still writ all over it. She looked up at me proudly. That was cleverly done, I said approvingly. The belling tower began to ring the hour, and Nina's expression flared into sudden panic. Oh, no, she said pitifully. I should have been back at the docks by now. My mom's gonna give me a birching. I laughed, partly because I was utterly amazed by this unexpected piece of luck, and partly at the thought of a young girl brave enough to defy the Chandrian, but still terrified of making her mother angry. Such is the way of the world. Nina, you've done me a wonderful favor. If you ever need anything, or if you have another dream, you can find me at an inn called Anchors. I play music there. Her eyes went wide. Is it magic music? I laughed again. Some people think so. She looked around nervously. I really have to go, she said, then waved and took off running toward the river, the wind blowing her hood back as she went. I carefully re-rolled the piece of paper and tucked it back into the hollow piece of horn. My mind spun with what I had just learned. I thought of what I'd heard Haliak say to Cinder all those years ago. Who keeps you safe from the Aemir? The singers? The Sith? After my months of searching, I was fairly certain the archives held nothing more than fairy stories about the Chandrian. Nobody considered them more real than shamblemen or fairies. But everyone knew about the Aemir. They were the bright knights of the Aeturan Empire. They were the strong hand of the church for 200 years. They were the subject of 100 stories and songs. I knew my history. The Aemir had been founded by the Talyn Church in the early days of the Aeturan Empire. But the pottery Nina had seen had been much older than that. I knew my history. The Aemir had been condemned and disbanded by the church before the empire fell. But I knew the Chandrian were still afraid of them today. It seemed like there was more to the story. Chapter 36. All This Knowing. Days passed, and I invited Will and Sim across the river to celebrate our successful campaign against Ambrose. Given my taste for Sauten, I was not much of a drinker, but Will and Sim were kind enough to demonstrate the fine points of the art. We visited several different taverns, just for variety, but eventually we ended up back at the Aeolian. I preferred it because of the music, Simon because of the women, and Willem because it served Scutton. I was moderately well-buttered when I was called up onto the stage, but it takes more than a little drink to make me fumble-fingered. Just to prove I was not drunk, I made my way through Whither With He With The Withy, a song that's difficult enough to articulate when sober as a stone. The audience loved it and showed its appreciation in the appropriate way. And since I was not drinking Sauten that night, much of the evening is lost to living memory. The three of us walked the long road back from the Aeolian. There was a crispness to the air that spoke of winter, but the three of us were young and warmed from the inside by many drinks. A breeze pushed my cloak back, and I took a full, happy breath. Then a sudden panic seized me. "Where's my loot?" I asked, more loudly than I'd intended.
"You left it with Stanchion at the Aeolian,"
Willem said. He was afraid you would trip over it and break your neck.
Simon had stopped in the middle of the road. I bumped into him, lost my balance, and tumbled to the ground. He hardly seemed to notice.
Well, he said seriously, I certainly don't feel up to that right now.
Stonebridge rose ahead of us, 200 feet from end to end, with a high arch that peaked 5 stories above the river. It was part of the great stone road, straight as a nail, flat as a table, and older than God. I knew it weighed more than a mountain. I knew it had a 3-foot parapet running along both its edges. Despite all this knowing, I felt deeply uneasy at the thought of trying to cross it. I climbed unsteadily to my feet. As the three of us examined the bridge, Willem began to lean slowly to one side. I reached out to steady him, and at the same time, Simon laid hold of my arm, though whether to help me or to brace himself, I couldn't be certain.
I certainly don't feel up to that right now, Simon repeated. There's a place to sit over here, Willem said. Kella trail, Trenevorka.
Simon and I muffled our laughter, and Willem led us through the trees to a little clearing not 50 feet from the foot of the bridge. To my surprise, a tall gray stone stood at the middle of it, pointing skyward. Will entered the clearing with calm familiarity. I came more slowly, looking about curiously. Graystones are special to troopers, and seeing it gave rise to mixed feelings. Simon flopped down in the thick grass, while Willem settled his back against the trunk of a leaning birch. I moved to the graystone and touched it with my fingertips. It was warm and familiar.
"Don't push at that thing," Simon said nervously. "You'll tip it over."
I laughed.
"This stone has been here for 1,000 years, Sim. I don't think my breathing on it is going to hurt it." "Just come away from it. They're not good things."
"It's a gray stone," I said, giving it a friendly pat. "They mark old roads. If anything, we're safer being next to it. Gray stones mark safe places. Everyone knows that."
Sim shook his head stubbornly. "They're pagan relics."
"A jot says I'm right," I taunted.
"Ha!"
Still on his back, Sim held up a hand. I stepped over to slap it, formalizing our wager.
"We can go to the archives and settle it tomorrow," Sim said.
I sat down next to the graystone and had just started to relax when I was seized by a sudden panic.
"Body of God!" I said. "My loot!"
I tried to jump to my feet and failed, almost managing to knock out my brains against the graystone in the process. Simon tried to sit up and calm me, but the sudden motion was too much for him, and he fell awkwardly onto his side and began to laugh helplessly.
"This isn't funny!" I shouted.
"It's at the Aeolian," Willem said. "You've asked about it 4 times since we left."
"No, I haven't,"
I said with more conviction than I really felt. I rubbed my head where I'd knocked it against the graystone.
"There is no reason to be ashamed,"
Willem waved a hand dismissively.
"It is a man's nature to dwell on what sits close to his heart."
"I heard Kilvin got a few in him at the taps a couple months ago and wouldn't shut up about his new cold sulfur lamp," Simon said.
Will snorted.
"Lauren would rattle on about proper shelving behavior. Grasp by the spine! Grasp by the spine!"
he growled, and made clutching motions with both hands.
"If I hear him say it again, I will grasp his spine!"
A flash of memory came to me.
"Merciful Talu,"
I said, suddenly aghast.
"Did I sing Tinker Tanner at the Aeolian tonight?"
"You did," Simon said.
"I didn't know it had so many verses."
I wrinkled my forehead, trying desperately to remember.
"Did I sing the verse about the Talon and the sheep?"
It was not a good verse for polite company.
"Nya,"
Willem said.
"Thank God," I said.
"It was a goat,"
Willem managed seriously before he bubbled up into laughter.
"In the Talon's cassock!"
Simmons sang, then joined Willem in laughter.
No, no, I said miserably, resting my head in my hands. My mother used to make my dad sleep under the wagon when he sang that in public. Stanchion will beat me with a stick and take away my pipes next time I see him.
They loved it, Simmons reassured me.
I saw Stanchion singing along, Willem added. His nose was a little red by that time, too.
There was a long piece of comfortable quiet. Quoth? Simmons asked.
Yes?
Are you really a Demaru? The question caught me unprepared. Normally, it would have set me on edge, but at the moment, I didn't know how I felt about it.
Does it matter?
No. I was just wondering.
Oh.
I continued to watch the stars for a while.
Wondering what?
Nothing in particular, he said. Ambrose called you Rue a couple times, but he's called you other insulting things before.
It's not an insult, I said.
I mean, he's called you things that weren't true, Sim said quickly. You don't talk about your family, but you've said things that made me wonder. He shrugged, still flat on his back, looking up at the stars. I've never known one of the Edema.
Not well, anyway.
What you hear isn't true, I said. We don't steal children or worship dark gods or anything like that.
I never believed any of that, he said dismissively, then added. But some of the things they say must be true. I've never heard anyone play like you.
It doesn't have anything to do with my being a Demaru, I said, then reconsidered. Maybe a little.
Do you dance?
Willem asked, seemingly out of the blue. If the comment had come from anyone else, or at a different time, it probably would have started a fight.
That's just how people picture us, playing pipes and fiddles, dancing around our campfires. When we aren't stealing everything that isn't nailed down, of course.
A little bitterness crept into my tone when I said the last. That's not what being a Demaru is about.
What is it about? Simmons asked.
I thought about it for a moment, but my sodden wit wasn't up to the task.
We're just people, really, I said eventually, except we don't stay in one place very long, and everyone hates us.
The three of us watched the stars quietly.
Did she really make him sleep under the wagon? Simmons asked.
What?
You said your mom made your dad sleep under the wagon for singing the verse about the sheep.
Did she really?
It's mostly a figure of speech, I said.
But once she really did. I didn't often think of my early life in my troop, back when my parents were alive. I avoided the subject the same way a cripple learns to keep the weight off an injured leg. But Sim's question brought a memory bubbling to the surface of my mind. It wasn't for singing Tinker Tanner, I found myself saying. It was a song he'd written about her. It was quiet for a long moment. Then I said it. Lorien. It was the first time I'd said my mother's name in years. The first time since she'd been killed. It felt strange in my mouth. Then, without really meaning to, I began to sing. Dark Lorien, Arladin's wife, has a face like the blade of a knife, has a voice like a prickle-brown burr, but can tally a sum like a moneylender. My sweet Tally cannot cook, but she keeps a tidy ledger book. For all her faults, I do confess, it's worth my life to make my wife not tally a lot less. I felt oddly numb, disconnected from my own body. Strangely, while the memory was sharp, it wasn't painful.
I can see how that might earn a man a place under the wagon, Willem said gravely.
It wasn't that, I heard myself saying. She was beautiful, and they both knew it. They used to tease each other all the time. It was the meter. She hated the awful meter. I never talked about my parents, and referring to them in the past tense felt uncomfortable. Disloyal. Will and Sim weren't surprised by my revelation.
Anyone who knew me could tell I had no family. I'd never said anything, but they were good friends. They knew.
In Aetur, we sleep in the kennels when our wives are angry, Simmons said, nudging the conversation back into safer territory.
Melosirehu, Idestiti,
Willem muttered.
Aeturin!
Simmons shouted, his voice bubbling with amusement.
No more of your donkey talk!
Idestiti? I repeated. You sleep next to fire? Willem nodded.
I am officially protesting how quickly you picked up Ciaru, Sim said, holding up a finger. I studied a year before I was any good. A year! You gobble it up in a single term.
I learned a lot growing up, I said. I was just getting the fine points this term.
Your accent is better, Will said to Sim. Quoth sounds like some southern trader. Very low. You sound much more refined.
Sim seemed mollified by that.
Next to the fire, he repeated.
Does it seem odd that it's the men that always have to do their sleeping somewhere else?
It's pretty obvious women control the bed, I said.
Not an unpleasant thought, Sim said.
Depending on the woman.
Distrel is pretty, Sim said.
Kheh,
Will said.
Too pale. Fella.
Simmons shook his head mournfully.
Out of our league.
She's Modagan,
Willem said, his grin so wide it was almost demonic.
She is? Sim asked.
Will nodded, wearing the widest smile I'd ever seen on his face. Sim sighed wretchedly.
It figures.
Bad enough that she's the prettiest girl in the Commonwealth. I didn't know she was Modagan, too.
I'll grant you the prettiest girl on her side of the river, I corrected. On this side, there's...
You've already gone on about your Denna, Will interrupted. 5 times.
Listen, Simmons said, his tone suddenly serious. You just have to make your move. This Denna girl is obviously interested in you. She hasn't said anything along those lines.
They never say they're interested.
Simmons laughed at the absurdity of it.
There are little games. It's like a dance.
He held up 2 hands, making them talk to each other.
Oh, fancy meeting you here. Why, hello. I was just going to lunch. What a happy coincidence. So was I. Can I carry your books?
I held up a hand to stop him. Can we skip to the end of this puppet show where you end up sobbing into your beer for a span of days? Simmons scowled at me. Willem laughed. She has enough men fawning over her, I said. They come and go like... I strained to think of an analogy and failed. I'd rather be your friend.
You would rather be close to her heart, Willem said, without any particular inflection. You would rather be joyfully held in the circle of her arms, but you fear she will reject you. You fear she would laugh, and you would look the fool.
Willem shrugged easily.
You are hardly the first to feel this way. There is no shame in it.
That struck uncomfortably close to the mark, and for a long moment, I couldn't think of anything to say in reply. I hope, I admitted quietly. But I don't want to assume. I've seen what happens to the men that assume too much and cling to her.
Willem nodded solemnly. She bought you that loot case? Sim said helpfully. That has to mean something.
But what does it mean? I said. It seems like she's interested, but what if it's just wishful thinking on my part? All those other men must think she's interested too, but they're obviously wrong. What if I'm wrong, too?
You'll never know unless you try, Sim said with a bitter edge to his voice.
That's what I'd normally say. But you know what? It doesn't work worth a damn. I chase them, and they kick at me like I'm a dog at the dinner table. I'm tired of trying so hard.
He gave a weary sigh, still flat on his back.
All I want is someone who likes me. All I want is a clear sign, I said.
I want a magical horse that fits in my pocket, Will said, and a ring of red amber that gives me power over demons, and an endless supply of cake.
There was another moment of comfortable quiet. The wind brushed gently through the trees.
They say the Rue know all the stories in the world, Simmons said after a while.
Probably true, I admitted.
Tell one, he said.
I eyed him narrowly.
Don't look at me like that, he protested. I'm in the mood for a story, that's all.
We are somewhat lacking for entertainment, Willem said.
Fine, fine, let me think.
I closed my eyes, and a story with the Amir in it bubbled to the surface. Hardly surprising. They had been on my mind constantly since Nina had found me. I sat up straight.
All right.
I took a breath, then paused. If either of you have to go piss, do it now. I don't like having to stop halfway through. Silence. Okay. I cleared my throat.
There is a place not many folk have seen. A strange place called Feyrinial. If you believe the stories, there are two things that make Feyrinial unique. First, it is where all the roads in the world meet. Second, it's not a place any man has ever found by searching. It's not a place you travel to. It's the place you pass through while on your way to somewhere else. They say that anyone who travels long enough will come there. This is a story of that place, and of an old man on a long road, and of a long and lonely night without a moon. Chapter 37 A Piece of Fire. Feyrinial was a great crossroads, but there was no inn where the roads met. Instead, there were clearings in the trees where travelers would set their camps and pass the night. Once, years ago and miles away, five groups of travelers came to Feyrinial. They chose their clearings and lit their fires as the sun began to set, pausing on their way from here to there. Later, after the sun had set and night was settled firmly in the sky, an old beggar in a tattered robe came walking down the road. He moved with slow care, leaning on a walking stick. The old man was going from nowhere to nowhere. He had no hat for his head and no pack for his back. He had not a penny or a purse to put it in. He barely even owned his own name, and even that had been worn thin and threadbare through the years. If you'd asked him who he was, he would have said, "Nobody." But he would have been wrong. The old man made his way into Feyrinial. He was hungry as a dry fire and weary to his bones. All that kept him moving was the hope that someone might give him a bit of dinner and a piece of their fire. So when the old man saw firelight flickering, he left the road and made his weary way toward it. Soon he saw four tall horses through the trees. Silver was worked into their harness, and silver was mixed with the iron of their shoes. Nearby, the beggar saw a dozen mules laden with goods, woolen cloth, cunning jewelry, and fine steel blades. But what caught the beggar's attention was the side of meat above the fire, steaming and dripping fat onto the coals. He almost fainted at the sweet smell of it, for he had been walking all day with nothing to eat but a handful of acorns and a bruised apple he'd found by the side of the road. Stepping into the clearing, the old beggar called out to the three dark-bearded men who sat around the fire.
"Hello," he said. "Can you spare a bit of meat and a piece of your fire?"
They turned, their gold chains glittering in the firelight.
"Certainly," their leader said. "What do you have with you, bits or pennies? Rings or strelum? Or do you have the true ringing Sealdish coin we prize above all others?"
"I have none of these,"
the old beggar said, opening his hands to show they were empty.
"Then you will find no comfort here," they said,
and as he watched, they began to carve thick pieces from the haunch that hung by the fire.
No offense, Willem. It's just how the story goes.
I didn't say anything.
You looked like you were going to.
I may, but it will wait until after.
The old man walked on, following the light of another fire through the trees.
Hello!
The old beggar called out as he stepped into the second clearing. He tried to sound cheerful, though he was weary and sore.
Can you spare a bit of meat and a piece of your fire?
There were four travelers there, two men and two women. At the sound of his voice, they rose to their feet, but none of them spoke. The old man waited politely, trying to appear pleasant and harmless, but the quiet stretched on, long as long, and still no word was spoken. Understandably, the old man grew irritated. He was used to being shunned or shrugged aside, but these folk merely stood. They were quiet and restless, moving from foot to foot while their hands twitched nervously. Just as he was about to sulk away, the fire flared and the beggar saw the four wore the blood-red clothes that marked them as Adem mercenaries. Then the old man understood. The Adem are called the Silent Folk, and they speak only rarely. The old man knew many stories of the Adem. He'd heard that they possessed a secret craft called the Lethani. This let them wear their quiet like an armor that would turn a blade or stop an arrow in the air. This is why they seldom spoke. They saved their words, keeping them inside like coals in the belly of a furnace. Those hoarded words filled them with so much restless energy that they could never be completely still, which is why they were always twitching and fidgeting about. Then, when they fought, they used their secret craft to burn those words like fuel inside themselves. This made them strong as bears and fast as snakes. When the beggar first heard these rumors, he thought them silly campfire stories. But years ago in Modeg, he had seen an Adem woman fight the city guard. The soldiers were armed and armored, thick of arm and chest. They had demanded to see the woman's sword in the king's name, and though hesitant, she presented it to them. As soon as they held it in their hands, they had leered and pawed at her, making lewd suggestions about what she could do to get it back. They were tall men with bright armor, and their swords were sharp. They fell like autumn wheat before her. She killed three of them, breaking their bones with her hands. Her own wounds were minor by comparison. A dark bruise along one cheek, a slight limp, a shallow cut across one hand. Even after all the long years, the old man remembered the way she had licked the blood from the back of her hand like a cat. This is what the old beggar thought of when he saw the Adem standing there. All thought of food and fire left him, and he backed slowly into the shelter of the surrounding trees. Then he set off toward the next fire, hoping third time would prove lucky. At this clearing were a number of Aeturans standing around a dead donkey lying near a cart. One of them spotted the old man.
Look! He pointed. Grab him! We'll hitch him to the cart and make him pull!
The old man darted back into the trees, and after running to and fro, he lost the Aeturans by hiding under a pile of moldering leaves. When the sound of the Aeturans faded, the old man dragged himself from the leaves and found his walking stick. Then, with the courage of one who is poor and hungry, he set off to the fourth fire he saw in the distance. There, he might have found what he was looking for, because around the fire were traders from Vintas. Had things been different, they might have welcomed him to dinner, saying, "Where six can eat, seven can eat." But by this point, the old man was quite a sight. His hair stuck from his head in wild disarray. His robe, ragged before, was now torn and dirty. His face was pale from fright, and his breathing groaned and wheezed in his chest. Because of this, the Vints gasped and made gestures before their faces. They thought he was a Barrow-drog, you see, one of the unquiet dead that superstitious Vints believe walk the night. Each of the Vints had a different thought as to how they could stop him. Some thought fire would frighten him off. Some thought salt scattered on the grass would keep him away. Some thought iron would cut the strings that held the soul to his dead body. Listening to them argue, the old beggar realized that no matter what they agreed on, he would not be the better for it.